Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, this is Backstory with the American History Guys.
Welcome to the show. I'm Brian Ballow, here with Peter Onuf.
Hey, Brian.
And Ed Ayers.
Hey, Brian.
And we're going to begin today with the incredible story of the passenger pigeon.
Yeah, so the passenger pigeon was basically unbelievable.
This is Jennifer Price, a historian at Princeton.
Like, if you think about the biggest flock of starlings you've ever seen that seems like a scene out of Hitchcock, and then you multiply that by about a million.
I can well remember that in the spring of 1811, a flock passed over Templeton that was many hours in sight, and so large as to cover the whole horizon. They first appeared about a half an hour before sunrise and continued until after 10 o'clock.
This is from the diary of a Massachusetts man named Christopher Baldwin, one of the many terrifying accounts from this period of pigeon flocks that were many hundreds of miles long.
Keep in mind that these passages are invariably preceded by a couple sentences saying, I was sober, I had witnesses, I didn't make this up.
As the watchers stared, the hum increased to a mighty throbbing. Now everyone was out of the houses and stores, looking apprehensively at the growing cloud, which was blotting out the rays of the sun. Children screamed and ran for home. Women gathered their long skirts and hurried to the shelter of stores. Horses bolted. A few people mumbled frightened words about the approach of the millennium, and several dropped on their knees and prayed.
If that wasn't terrifying enough to contemplate, imagine what it would have been like when these millions of birds actually landed.
There were like 100-year-old foot-wide trees that would just keel over under the weight of the pigeons. And so there's this sort of this hail of falling branches and falling trees and bludgeoned pigeons that come down with the branches and the trees. And then, you know, by the time the pigeons would actually leave a roost site, or especially a nesting site where they might stay for a few weeks, it would just look like the apocalypse had come. You know, there was like not a single green leaf left. There'd be at least a foot of dung on the ground. These would be actually very fertile places for a while. There'd be fallen trees all over the place.
The only thing more striking than the sheer numbers of these passenger pigeons is the speed with which they disappeared from the face of the earth. In the 1880s, this larger, more colorful relative of the street pigeon we know today was still the most populous vertebrate in North America. A decade later, it was hard to find a flock of them anywhere. They had always been prized for the meat. What seems to have happened is that indiscriminate hunting, together with deforestation and disease, reduced the birds' numbers below a critical threshold necessary for the species' survival. The very last passenger pigeon died 100 years ago this September at the Cincinnati Zoo.
It's probably fair to say that the bird's death, her name was Martha, marked a turning point in the way Americans understood their role in the natural world. Today on the show, we're marking Earth Day with an in-depth look at some of the other ways Americans have thought about extinction.
We have stories about Thomas Jefferson's resistance to the idea that living species could disappear, and about a court case from the 1970s that made extinction into a political hot potato. But first, we're going to spend a few more minutes with Jennifer Price, who has written about the twists and turns in Americans' relationship with the passenger pigeon. She explained to me that these tremendous flocks of birds only came around every few years.
So pigeons ate beech nuts and acorns. They relied on old growth trees, really. And beech trees and oak trees only have a really big crop about every 2 to 8 years. And so that's why the pigeons would move around quite a bit, and they wouldn't show up in one place reliably. They would show up maybe every 6 or 7 years. Now, whenever this would happen, beginning with the Native Americans, this was an event. This was a huge event. You know, the Native Americans actually relied on pigeons for subsistence. And wherever the pigeons were, the Native American groups would gather. And they would often actually schedule their sort of, you know, intertribal council meetings around the pigeon nestings.
So we're in the early 19th century, and the pigeons are coming through all the towns and cities of the East. But for some reason, the locus of the pigeon hunting moves west. Can you tell us why that happens?
Well, I think it's really a story of technology and markets. Mm-hmm. What happens to the pigeon markets is the pigeon markets start out local on the East Coast, also in the Midwest, wherever the pigeons are, because you just can't send a pigeon very far before it turns into mush.
I see.
So there's a limit on how big the markets can get. Then what happens is you get the railroads, which spread out across the country, and you also get really important new technologies for preservation. So you get cold storage cars on the trains.
Mm-hmm.
So then what happens is you can have professional market hunters who are actually using the railroad lines to get to the communities, not just where the pigeons are, but where all the game species are, and then using the refrigerated cars to ship all this game back to the eastern markets where the game has been eradicated really decades before that. And so what happens is the reason you get the pigeon eradication in the 1870s is that's when the markets and the railroads finally reach sort of the last, you know, pieces
refuge
of the continent.
Right.
Yeah.
And so did people put out warnings? Oh, look out. Mm-hmm. If we keep shooting these pigeons, we're going to wipe them out. Were there warnings like that?
No, because you have to remember that the pigeons don't show up in any one locale every year. So there's a lag time in realizing that the pigeons are gone because they're travelers. So there's
right.
a real lag time of almost, I would say, a decade or two, even two decades, where it really starts to sink in that the pigeons are gone, because it's also just so inconceivable to people. Like, they just don't think it's possible that they could not be around. And so really the first people that start to notice it is, of course, this small core of market hunters who actually makes their living by following the flocks from year to year. And they show up at 1880, and there's a few thousand pigeons, and they go off to look for the main flock, and they don't find it.
Wow.
But it really takes a very long time to sink in, and people just assume. I mean, really, up until like the 1960s, people are saying, oh, I saw some in Bolivia. I saw some on the coast of Russia. They flew to Alaska. You know, there's this sense that the pigeons just got disgusted and went elsewhere. And by the time people realize that they're really gone, it's way too late to do anything about it.
So you mentioned in your book of the monuments that were put up in Wisconsin to the last flocks of pigeons. And they say the explanation for this is pretty straightforward. It's the avarice of man.
Yes. In general, every time you see people talk about the extinction, it's man's greed, man's avarice, man's thoughtlessness. My explanation is a little bit longer than that. And it's really two parts. First is that it's not man's greed.
Mm-hmm.
It's particular people in a particular economy with a particular social structure who are putting particular kinds of pressures on natural resources for particular reasons. And you really, if you don't really look very specifically at, you know, the market forces that really drove the pigeons extinct, then I think you don't get much of a lesson out of it. But the other thing that I think is really important that we lose track of is that these pigeons were actually really meaningful to people. Yes, people were shooting them like crazy in ways that were actually ultimately really destructive, but they also really loved pigeons. And pigeons represented things to them. You know, the pigeons would come in, and it was just this abundance beyond imagination. And it really said a lot to people about their identity as Americans. You know, game had been long depleted in Britain and in Europe,
right,
you know, in the
right.
European countries. It had been depleted for centuries and centuries. And one of the things that was really defining about American identity was this abundance of natural resources. And when the pigeons would come in, it would just tell that story, you know, 50 times over. And also about independence, that people could go and they could shoot. You know, in Europe, you had a lot of restrictions on who could hunt game. In the United States, everybody could hunt game. And then the pigeons also brought communities together. Everybody in the community would drop what they're doing. Shops would be empty. Restaurants would be empty. People would just all go to the pigeon roost. And so it also told you a story about your community and about people coming together and doing things together. So pigeons, because of this dramatic quality that they had, have always been really meaningful to people. And that is still true. You know, why are we talking about pigeons in 2014? You know, they're still really, really good animals for telling us stories. And now we use pigeons to tell sort of cautionary stories about our relationships with nature.
That's beautiful. And I thought one of the beautiful things in your chapter was the way that you talk about when we go to the grocery store today and buy meat, you know, we get it beneath shrink wrap and, you know, precisely mm-hmm. weighed. So is that the basic thing that happened, is that the pigeons had been meaningful to people who actually saw them and killed them and cooked them in pies? But mm-hmm. the urban consumers, and you talk about the rise of the restaurant. And the pigeon, by the time you get that, it's wrapped not only in all other kinds of foods and sort of draped with kind of garnish, but it's also dressed in French language. Is that what happens? Is that we lose the sense of meaning and of consequence? Or am I imposing a false simplicity?
No. I think this is definitely an important part of the story, is that the meanings of pigeons, it's not that people aren't still attaching meanings to the pigeons on their plates, but it's rather that those meanings become very abstracted, very disconnected from the actual pigeon. You know, like you said, the pigeon, you can't even tell it's a pigeon by the time Delmonico's gets done with it. I mean, there are pigeon dishes that take them 2 days to prepare. They're like 12 different, it's almost like a seafood tower, you know, like now 12 pigeons arranged on a many different layers with about a billion sauces on them and all kinds of truffles and veggies. And so the pigeon, it's not that people aren't making the bird meaningful, but they're making them meaningful in ways that are disconnected from the flocks and the meanings of the flocks. So when the pigeon actually disappears, who cares? I mean, it's the market hunters that get blamed, and it's the locals in Wisconsin and Michigan that get blamed. But they're really no more to blame than the consumers who are demanding the pigeons for the markets.
Right. Which seems to be the theme of your story, right? And I think it's meaning for us today, is that it's easy to point at the people with the guns and coming out on the railroads and so forth doing this. But the fact is it takes a nation to destroy millions of pigeons. I mean, it takes the most urbane, sophisticated consumers, as well as people who are making a living off wildlife sort of flying through their neighborhood.
I think that it is a story about using local finite resources for much, much broader markets. And like you said, you know, it takes a nation to destroy the pigeon. But I think the lesson is partly also that it takes a nation to save the pigeons. That, you know, regulation can't just be local and, you know, that we need. And this, in fact, is what eventually saved game species from being wiped out entirely, is that by the 1900s, when we say, oh, my God, the continent has just been emptied of its wildlife, they pass national laws for the first times. And those have been enormously effective, actually, in saving a lot of species.
Jennifer Price is a visiting professor at the Princeton Environmental Institute. We'll link to an excerpt from her book, Flight Maps, at backstoryradio.org.
You're listening to Backstory.
Today on the show, we're marking Earth Day, ironically, with a look back at the various ways Americans have thought about extinction. While we were putting the show together, we received this voicemail on the subject from one of our listeners.
Hi, guys. I love the show. This is Charles from Newport, Kentucky. And I heard a few years ago that the idea of extinction was as controversial as the theory of evolution was in Darwin's day. The thought being, why would God create and then destroy so many animals? I wonder what you guys thought of that.
What I think of it is, I love you, Charles, because that's the very question I wanted to ask our 18th and 19th century guys. I mean, it seems to me that if evolution was such a bombshell, then it is a necessity that extinction would be equally disruptive to ideas in the 19th century. I'm looking at you, Ed.
Well, you might think what you just said, Brian, but it's not really the case, ironically. I mean, Charles's question and your question are very well placed, but it turns out that Darwin was very much a man of the 19th century, and which he was talking about progress and evolution. And he doesn't even use the word evolution. That's how polite he is. He talks about descent with modification. He does that until the sixth edition of his book.
I'll have another cup of tea, eh?
Yeah, exactly. Descent with modification. So Darwin instead talks about the way that very gradually, so gradually you can't actually see it except in retrospect, organisms of all kinds are subtly adapting to their changing environment. The controversy grows out of the concept of evolution, that what are we descended with modification from?
Right.
And that the fact that we are not a stable biological entity is where the real controversy lies, Brian, not with the idea of extinction.
Ed, I think you're right to situate Darwin in the Victorian 19th century, and there's kind of a sentimental view, and it's good. There is individual loss, but for the human race as a whole and for creation as a whole, we're moving forward in a sort of gentle, gradual way. Now, that's a counterpoint to a cataclysmic, catastrophic notion of the history of the world. And according to Charles Cuvier, a French natural philosopher of the late 18th century of the Napoleonic period, there have been a series of cataclysms, five of them, which have led to massive extinctions. But before Cuvier, the idea of the Enlightenment natural philosophers was that a clockmaker god had created a perfect creation in which there was a kind of completeness. It was static. All species would exist forever. The great chain of being was the dominant idea. There's order in God's creation, and no link can be taken from the chain of being without the whole thing collapsing. And it's that idea that comes apart. And, you know, what I think's really significant about Cuvier and this notion of extinction as an existential threat to the planet and to all species is that that prediction, that notion, or that gloss on world history takes place within the context of the Napoleonic Wars, which wreak awful destruction on the European continent. The significant thing in the U.S. is their revolution didn't have the implications of the French Revolution. The American Revolution was gradualist. It was possible.
Darwinian.
Yeah, it was possible for Americans to be conservative progressives, to believe that things would get better, and yes, there would be loss, but it would be a gentle
Peter,
loss.
I am so sold on your theory, but I'm just going to jump in here and say certainly by the 1970s in the United States, we've got it all. We've got this notion that everything is connected. That comes out of ecology.
Right.
And it sounds very much like that great chain of being you're referring
Earth
to.
Earth Day in 1970.
Exactly. Right. Everything is connected. The Earth is this delicate marble that we can look at from the sky. Right. On the other hand, we have plenty of controversy. And you know what that controversy comes from? It comes from the notion that humans are destroying and making extinct pieces of that great interconnectedness. And the controversy is over exactly what we're talking about. Does it really matter that the spotted owl might disappear?
So what strikes me is that that modern notion, as you've suggested, is very similar to an 18th century idea that there is an order to nature. It's
right.
organized along a different axis. Now we see everything in horizontal terms. Everything is equal on our planet. And we, of all creatures in creation, are uniquely responsible for its fate.
And so, Charles, to bring things full circle, ironically, Darwin's the least of our problems. Extinction's controversial in lots of different ways, but not for the reasons that we might expect. So Peter was just talking about the ways that Americans wrapped their heads around the idea of extinction in the early days of the nation. Now we're going to take a closer look at how another scientific theory from across the pond landed in the United States. And that theory was known somewhat ominously as the theory of American degeneracy.
In 1766, the world's most well-known natural scientist, Comte de Buffon, published his theory that life forms on the American continent were naturally weaker and smaller than their old world counterparts. The French naturalist's idea was basically that the cold and damp climate stunted the growth of America's flora, fauna, and even the people. As you can imagine, this idea was not very well received in America. My man, Thomas Jefferson, devoted a significant chunk of his only book, Notes on the State of Virginia, to disproving Buffon's idea. Notes on Virginia compares the relative sizes of species on both sides of the Atlantic, making the point that accurate data would show there was no such thing as degeneration. If anything, Jefferson suggested, American animals were bigger.
If you read Jefferson's book today, some of his data might seem a little off. And here's where 18th century ideas about extinction and degeneracy intersect. You see, one of the main animals that Jefferson used to prove his point was the mammoth, the same mammoth that we now know went extinct thousands of years earlier.
Lee Dugatkin is a biologist at the University of Louisville who has written about Jefferson's efforts to undo the degeneracy theory. He told me that Jefferson insisted on the relevance of the mammoth to his argument, even though it was pretty evident by Jefferson's time that this animal was long gone.
What he's basing his empirical sense that this creature still exists is on stories that Indian folklore had of such creatures that were roaming around much further west than we had been at that time, because this is pre-Lewis and Clark. And, you know, Jefferson, who we think of as sort of the quintessential logical person, really has to twist and turn to make his arguments about the mammoth being still here. What he says is people ask me, well, where is the evidence that it's out west? And his answer is, show me the evidence that it isn't. Which right. is, for Jefferson, that's a bit of a weak argument. One senses that he knew that, but that's all he was left with. And so that's what he used.
Why is it so important? Why is Jefferson so deeply invested in this? Why does he want to refute the notion of degeneracy under the conditions that Buffon thinks exist in the New World? It's cold, it's wet. And he's got the climate wrong, for starters.
Right.
But what's at stake for Jefferson?
Jefferson was very worried that what would happen would be Buffon would be seen as the world's leading expert on this subject. Everybody in Europe, therefore, would accept this argument, which means that people, particularly people with money, would not begin trading with the United States, would not come over here. So from a practical perspective, Jefferson was worried that this was going to hurt our chances of survival as a country.
And there is the parallel argument that the United States is an experiment, and they use that word advisedly, in Republican government. And the American people are going to demonstrate what they're capable of doing. These slurs on American nature are really slurs on the American people as well, and a prediction that the United States will fail.
Without question. And what's really remarkable is Jefferson realized this, and so did the early natural historians in the country. So if you look at the early school of American natural history, you find these wonderful letters where they write each other that what should drive them is not only their love for nature and their passion for the subject, but national pride. We need to demonstrate to the world that this place, America, is just as beautiful, just as strong, in possession of just the incredible animals that the rest of the world is in possession of, because it paints a picture of us as not only an emerging republic, but an emerging place where people are strong and where nature is powerful.
Yeah. Now, Lee, if Jefferson could have done it, wouldn't he have sent the mastodon or a skeleton of the mastodon to Buffon and said, listen, this is the game changer here. We got the big one. Why couldn't he do that?
Jefferson understood that even though he thought and was convinced that the mammoth was roaming around out west, that without hard evidence that this was the case, the mammoth in some ways was not the perfect piece of evidence to send Buffon, because what Jefferson thought was, what we need is something that's roaming around in the forests today that everybody knows about here.
Okay, so we'll hold the mammoth in reserve because one day we will find the mammoth, or at least a mammoth skeleton.
Yeah, what Jefferson decides is what we're going to do is we're going to get our hands on a giant moose, one that's preferably 7 to 10 feet tall.
Whoa.
And we are going to ship it over to the Count, and he is going to look and say, you know, I guess I was wrong. Unfortunately, the Count is very ill at this time. So by this time, which is 1786, 1787, Buffon is in his mid-70s, and he's quite ill. The Count's assistant writes back to Jefferson that the Count has seen the moose, and he is going to essentially pull back his theory of New World.
Man, this is a victory almost, right?
Almost a victory, except Buffon dies very shortly thereafter, and he doesn't pull back the theory of New World degeneracy. So Jefferson knew that Buffon knew that Jefferson was right. And that gave him a bit of solace,
but
he was quite concerned that this this theory of New World degeneracy was going to last for a long time. And of course, one can't help but think that part of the reason that Lewis and Clark went out west was to document all the things we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. Jefferson wanted hard evidence of the amazing nature of this country. And so we sent Lewis and Clark out to get it because that was where the future was. And we knew nothing about what was out there. And Jefferson and others thought, once we do, we can finally put this whole argument about us being degenerate to rest.
Lee Dugatkin is an evolutionary biologist at the University of Louisville. He's the author of Mr. Jefferson and the Giant Moose, Natural History in Early America.
More than a century after Jefferson tried to get his hands on an entire skeleton from a mastodon, Americans were much more interested in a different creature from the past, the dinosaur. People flocked to the halls of the Field Museum in Chicago, the Museum of Natural History in New York, and the Carnegie Museum in Pittsburgh. They were there to see the breathtaking remains of the T-Rex and the Brontosaurus. And museums jockeyed to get their hands on the biggest skeletons they could find.
In one case, you had Andrew Carnegie, the famous philanthropist, who saw a news article about a giant sauropod dinosaur, so one of these long-necked, heavy-bodied dinosaurs being found out west.
This is Brian Switek, a science journalist who's written about this period of dinomania.
And there's an illustration in the newspaper of this dinosaur standing up on its hind legs and looking into, I think, the 10th-story window of an early skyscraper and said, I want one of these for my museum. You will go and find this for me. And they did. They found a Diplodocus, actually, and named it after him, the specific species, Diplodocus carnegii.
Americans at this time were also getting much more interested in the reasons dinosaurs went extinct. As we mentioned earlier in today's show, extinction up until this point had been seen as a gradual process of nature. But right around the time of World War I, people started coming up with more cataclysmic theories, theories that Switek says map very nicely onto the social and political realities of the day.
You start getting ideas about that maybe mammals are eating all the dinosaur eggs. So rather than dinosaurs, sort of evolving themselves to be extinct, you have this outside pressure, mammals eating all the eggs that are driving them extinct. So, that hasn't been taken seriously. That didn't actually work, but you're starting to get those sorts of ideas. So you have that within science, but then you also have sort of dinosaurs becoming symbols of extinction. So there was a pacifist group during World War I called the Anti-Preparedness League.
And as their mascot, they must have had very poorly organized meetings.
Yeah. Who's going to organize the next meeting? I don't want to do it. Yeah.
So these folks were against preparing for World War I.
Right. They were a pacifist group. They didn't want America to get involved in World War I. And as their mascot, they picked a stegosaurus, this armor-plated dinosaur with the spiky tail. They called it Jingo because of the jingoism that they were pushing back against. And the slogan they put underneath their papier-mâché stegosaurus that they took out on parades was all armor plate and no brains. And this was going into this idea that, this dinosaur invested so much energy in, its own militarization that it wasn't smart enough to think of any other solution. So basically, this huge dumb brute that was destined to go extinct. And if the U.S. got involved in World War I, we'd be basically the giant stegosaurus that had the brain the size of a walnut and lots of armaments.
I actually owned some old cars like that in the 1970s. But any other examples you can share with us?
So another example for the dinosaurs is in the middle of the 20th century, you had Rachel Carson's highly influential book, Silent Spring. And part of that book was, identifying that DDT was a major environmental problem. It was thinning the eggshells of many raptors and other predatory birds and causing these birds to go extinct. After that, this was a little bit delayed, but about 20 years after Silent Spring came out, there was a set of papers about dinosaur eggs found in Europe, and they seemed to have thin eggs for dinosaurs, and they had egg deformities where you had a couple different eggshell layers, and the scientists said that there's this outgassing of sort of these toxins that came from volcanoes and were having a very similar effect in the past. And I don't know if that hypothesis ever would have been presented, I guess, without an awareness of ecological problems that people were facing at the
larger
time.
Larger concern about the food chain during the time of Rachel Carson.
Food chain, you know, chemicals in the environment and that sort of thing, you know, this awareness coming from another branch of science and another branch of cultural awareness and feeding back into theories about what happened to the dinosaurs.
So how else have human fears crept into theories about dinosaur extinction?
Well, certainly the greatest one has to be the asteroid impact hypothesis. Now, you know, the asteroid impact fact, basically, you know, 1980, it was this very controversial idea based upon this layer of a rare element called iridium found all around the world right at that spot between the end of the age of the non-avian dinosaurs 66 million years ago and the beginning of what was often called the age of mammals. And people in other sciences actually picked up on this, people like Carl Sagan. You know, this is during the Cold War era where people were worried about, you know, mutually assured nuclear destruction. And as paleontologists and geologists looked at this asteroid impact and said, okay, the asteroid struck the Earth, there would have been, you know, months, if not years, of darkness. It would have thrown all these chemicals into the air. The world would have chilled. Basically, the idea of nuclear winter was drawn at least partly from the asteroid impact, that this was basically a proxy for what we might do to ourselves. So the asteroid impact was brought into these political debates about, you know, getting rid of our nuclear arsenal.
So do present concerns like climate change, have they made their way into the scientific theories of dinosaur extinction?
I think it certainly does in terms of how science is reported and the sort of media hooks that are used. There was a paper that came out, I think, about 2 years ago about dinosaur farts, of all things, and how much basically one of these long-necked sauropod dinosaurs would have produced. You know, and could they have altered the global climate through this? It had nothing to do with extinction because these dinosaurs had, you know, survived for millions and millions and millions of years. They showed no sign of sort of petering out. But the news media, especially outlets like Fox News and stuff, immediately latched on to this and, you know, started saying that dinosaurs must have farted themselves into extinction. And anything where you can tie, you know, dinosaurs to climate change and extinction, that's an immediate news hook for anyone looking for an easy story.
So some of this has less to do with changes in the scientific theory itself and a lot to do with what the media translates for larger publics. And of course, I want to underscore, you are a science writer. So you contribute to this phenomenon?
I think I certainly do. At least I'd like to think that I do. That means people are reading what I have to say and therefore taking it in. But, you know, I remember those documentaries I saw about the asteroid impact and other paleontologists, you know, of my generation, I'm 31, if it helps put a timestamp on it, are now, you know, starting to be curators and starting to have an influence in the field and writing scientific papers. And there seems to be this generational difference between the people who are active as academics, you know, in these debates who are still sort of not skeptical, but still, you know, very actively debating what role did, you know, asteroid impact versus volcanic activity have in this extinction, and people of my generation who grew up with, you know, all these dinosaur shows and media saying the asteroid is the answer, and I think there's a greater acceptance with us about that. So it can take a little bit more work, I think, especially for me as a science communicator, to remember these other ideas and say, okay, this is what we know, and this is what's still being discussed, and that's a responsibility that I have to remind myself of: is am I accurately reflecting the state of the science and what we don't know yet?
So as a science communicator, tweet to me the reason that the dinosaurs went extinct. Your understanding.
Murder weapons, asteroid, volcano, motive unknown.
Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Brian Switek is the author of My Beloved Brontosaurus, On the Road with Old Bones, New Science, and Our Favorite Dinosaurs.
They used to swim, they used to fly with a toothy grin.
It's time for a short break. When we return, the story of the little fish that threatened a really big dam.
Or the dinosaurs, big ass trees.
This is Backstory, the show where we look at the past to understand the America of today. I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Brian Bellow. On today's show, we're talking about the history of American thinking about extinction. And we're going to turn now, Ed, to a story from your backyard down in Tennessee. It's the snail darter controversy.
Ah, yeah, I know this story. Everybody does down in Tennessee. It's the story of the little fish that got in the way of the Tennessee Valley Authority trying to build a big hydroelectric dam that would benefit so many people, right?
That's kind of right. You are right about the way the story played out in the media, and frankly, still does play out in the media. But that dam was never intended for hydropower. It was actually dreamed up as the first step in creating a lake and freeing up land for an office park and planned community for the Boeing Corporation.
Yeah, I have to admit, that's not the way I'd heard it, Brian.
The story began in the mid-60s when the TVA secured federal funds to dam up the last free-flowing section of the Little Tennessee River. But before long, Boeing pulled out of the project. The farmers in the 40 square miles that were going to be condemned managed to delay the dam for a few years. But in the early 70s, the TVA started building that dam. By 1973, it was 95% complete. But at that point, those farmers stumbled upon a last-ditch strategy for shutting down the whole thing. They would take advantage of the brand-new Endangered Species Act that had just been passed by Congress.
For an energy-hungry country, the news from a federal appeals court today could be described as bad.
This is Walter Cronkite in January of 1977, reporting on the first case to test the new Endangered Species Act.
The reason the hydroelectric dam threatens an endangered species, a 3-inch fish called the snail darter. A member of the perch family, it's found only in a 17-mile stretch of the river that's to be part of the Tellico Reservoir.
The following year, the case, Tennessee Valley Authority v. Hiram Hill, made its way to the Supreme Court. Hiram Hill was a law student who had heard about the fish, and his professor was the one who got the snail darter listed as an endangered species. And eventually, that professor argued the case in court. His name was Zygmunt Plotter.
At one point, Justice Powell leaned over and said, "Mr. Plotter, what purpose is served? Are they good for bait? Can you eat them?" And I was able to say, no, Your Honor, you can't eat it. You can't use it for bait. But at trial, Exhibit 12 is a lithograph which shows the little fish highly adapted to clean, cool, clear, flowing river water, which has been destroyed everywhere else in the region by the pork barrel development. And the interesting thing is, when I said Exhibit 12 at trial, the clerk of the United States Supreme Court jumped up and he went out and handed each member of the court a picture of this beautiful little fish looking out with little brown eyes. I said, wow.
Right. Suitable for framing, no doubt.
Exactly. And I figured that was good for at least one vote. And we won, 6-3.
And was the key issue whether the snail darter faced extinction? Was that word thrown around a lot?
Well, often when you look at endangered species cases, you're looking at a case of a canary in the coal mine. That little species is typically in a habitat that has been rendered rarer and rarer. This little fish, for instance, probably in the millions, used to live throughout the eastern half of Tennessee. But one by one by one by one, its populations have been destroyed by some of those 67 dams that had already been built.
Right.
Only 25,000 of these little things were left in the Little Tennessee River that was their prime habitat. They were vivid indicators that every other place where this fish had lived had been destroyed for humans. I guess the point is, the extinction of this little fish would mark the extinction of a remarkable public resource. And it was only through the accident of the Endangered Species Act being passed and my student Hank Hill hearing about this little fish, that we were be able to take it up to the Supreme Court and ultimately to the God Committee, which—
Time out. What is a God Committee?
I'd argued in the Supreme Court that Congress should finally sit down and look at the merits on both sides. TVA saying that there was going to be this city, which never would happen— and the farmers saying the true value is to have us on our farms, this prime soil, and have tourism and recreational fishing up through this 33 miles into the park. All right. The Congress set up a high-level committee, really quite extraordinary. Seven members of the president's cabinet listened for 2 or 3 hours and then unanimously said, this project was never worth building. The farmers were right. The trouble was, that didn't make it into the media. Little fish stops dam, that's in front of a front page above the fold. Economic analysis shows that the media story has been wrong from the beginning. It either wasn't covered in the AP Wire, or it was page 24 in the Times and page 12 in the Post, and it was extraordinarily frustrating. Stupid little fish, extreme environmentalists blocking human project, hydroelectricity. In fact, you get the idea today, still in Congress, in the last several months, the snail darter is used as an example, not only of the foolishness of the Endangered Species Act, but it's used to undercut environmental regulation generally, and even is being used as an example of government overregulation in general.
I see your point, but I want to ask you whether your side didn't have its own uses of the threat of extinction. If that didn't help mobilize support, didn't extinction do some work for your side as well?
Oh, absolutely. The threat of extinction to this little fish was essentially a shadow representation of the economic merits and the community merits of the farming and the fishing community on that little stretch of remaining river. But it turned out that in the legal system then and today, citizens had no way to raise the direct merits of these challengeable projects.
So, Zig, symbolism aside and the conservative reaction aside, you were popping champagne corks, right?
Well, we always had an eye on the politics because we had won in the Supreme Court. We'd won now unanimously in the God Committee, but America did not know that we had been making common sense. And that allowed the pork barrel to do what they did. Late one evening, with an empty House chamber, they sneaked a rider onto a multi-billion dollar appropriations bill, which overrode all federal law and ordered that the dam be completed right away, irrespective of the economics.
And did they build the dam?
So for 2 years, nothing happened. And then TVA started giving away the farmers' lands to development companies so that now McMansions line the lake. The land was condemned from the farmers for an average of $330 an acre. I was told that the land was being sold for a half acre for more than $100,000.
What about the snail darter?
The snail darter was transplanted to two lesser rivers. I'm pleased to say that it is back up to 25,000. It's extinct in its only natural habitat. But the problem is it's on life support. TVA has to put bubbling machines into the rivers where the snail darter has been transplanted to allow it to survive through the summer months.
So it's quite literally on life support. It's
literally on life support. But if I had named the case Teleco Farmers versus TVA, reporters would have wanted to talk to who? To the farmers. And they would have found out, what? Your lands are not being condemned for a hydroelectric lake. They're being condemned. I mean, 40 square miles of family farms were being condemned for resale by Boeing. That was the whole point. And America never got that message because I couldn't name the case Teleco Farmers versus TVA.
Zig, do you dream about the snail darter?
For 30 years, I sometimes would wake up in the middle of the night and turn over to Anne, and she would say, snail darter, and I would say yes. And she'd go, write the damn book.
Zygmunt Plotter is a law professor at Boston College. And in case you're wondering, he finally got around to writing that book. It was published last year under the title The Snail Darter in the Dam. You can listen to Zig's story of his very tense phone call about the snail darter with President Carter at backstoryradio.org. Throughout Throughout today's show, we've been reflecting on the ways Americans have thought about the extinction of non-humans. We're going to end our show on a bit of a different note, with a story about a theory of human extinction.
This story begins in the nation's early days, when some white Americans started articulating scientific-sounding theories to justify the institution of slavery. The idea, and you can see this taking shape in Thomas Jefferson's Notes on the State of Virginia in the 1780s, was that there was a natural physical hierarchy of the races. And the people at the lower end of this hierarchy were, by their very nature, unable to survive in a system that was not slavery. If they were freed, they were actually at risk of going extinct.
In the Civil War years, people who believed this found confirmation of the theory when smallpox and other diseases started ravaging the camps of newly freed people. And in the decades following, some prominent social scientists pointed to the high infant mortality rates, urban disease epidemics, and what turned out to be erroneous census results as evidence that black people were indeed dying out.
It is not in the conditions of life, but in the race traits and tendencies that we find the causes of the excessive mortality. So long as immorality and vice are a habit of life in the vast majority of the colored population, the effect will be to increase the mortality by hereditary transmission of weak constitutions, until the births fall below deaths and gradual extinction results.
This is an excerpt from the 1896 study, Race Traits and Tendencies of the American Negro. Its author was Frederick Hoffman, a number cruncher for Prudential Life Insurance and one of the most influential proponents of the black extinction hypothesis. Now, Hoffman argued that we shouldn't look to socioeconomic or environmental factors to explain the public health of black people, but rather to their immoral behavior. I sat down with NYU historian Michelle Mitchell to discuss the way that African Americans responded to Hoffman's diagnosis.
African Americans respond in a couple of ways. You have somebody such as W.E.B. Du Bois saying that any time that you have people who can use statistics or make claims about black extermination, they can barely, you know, contain their glee. You have, you know, these sort of reactions on that front. Among African Americans themselves, the answer becomes really pretty complicated because you have some reformers claiming that, okay, we are not as healthy as we should be. We have behaviors or habits that are detrimental. We live in conditions that are not the most healthful. And so you have this really complicated internal discourse that happens about what African Americans needed to do. And it really, it gets a little messy.
So you have the African American community itself debating whether or not there's any reality to this at all. And as you said, Du Bois just says white people can barely hide their glee when they think that African Americans might be going the way of the American Indians. It'll be sort of a problem that will just solve itself. But then there are these other reformers who say, you know, okay, yeah, but there does seem to be a real problem that our health is not really what it should be, and our children are not what they should be, and we're simply going to have to take care of ourselves because obviously white America is not going to.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go to a very sort of a controversial text, and it was controversial at the time, and it remains controversial, and it comes right on the heels of Frederick Hoffman.
Uh-huh.
It's William Hannibal Thomas's The American Negro. And this was a man who positioned himself as a descendant of free people of color, but he also took pains to distinguish himself from what he viewed as the sort of the mass black population. Mm-hmm. And he argued, and this is a quote, "An imperious sexual impulse in Negro character constitutes the main degeneracy of the race and is the chief hindrance to the race's social uplifting." And insinuates that extinction was a real possibility facing African Americans because of moral failings.
So how do these concerns about premarital sex and promiscuity lead to concerns about extinction? That would seem to be pointing in exactly the opposite direction.
Well, precisely. And this is where the discourse of eugenics and the notion of the well-born come into play, because eugenic discourse is also coming together during the late 19th, early 20th century. And so the argument would be that people might be having sex, they might be having sex young, but they are not necessarily producing healthy children that are going to survive. And so that's it's about also the quality of children being born. There are those arguments.
So this is actually something that the white critics and the African-American sort of internal critics seem to agree upon, right, is that this is a very hard time demographically for the African-American community.
Right.
So what do they suggest needs to be done?
Well, not surprisingly, marriage and keeping sexual intercourse within marriage, that being, you know, primary, one thing.
Right.
Another thing is arguments about trying to reform the home life, and you have a number of people speaking out about the evils of the one-room cabin, saying that this is something that we couldn't help but live with during slavery, but we don't need to, you know, continue to live in these conditions. So you have people making arguments about the need for privacy within homes. Margaret Murray Washington, Booker T. Washington's wife, and a real activist and educator, she is a leading force in the late 19th century in the formation of mothers' clubs, being sort of the mind that poor African-American women needed to learn how to properly care for their children. They needed to take care of themselves. They needed to keep a proper home. So you have club women who are taking hereditary arguments about African-Americans' supposed predisposition to degeneracy or dissipation. And they're saying, yes, there are these issues, but these are things that we can control, and we can do things to improve the environments in our homes and in ourselves. So you have that going on, too.
So, Michelle, in the largest picture, what are we to make of this very long conversation?
I think the thing that we are to make of this conversation, and even when you look at African Americans' own conversations about disease, about degeneracy, about possible extinction, there's always a question mark in terms of whether or not this is actually happening, whether or not these problems are actually severe, whether or not there actually is a moral issue that's at the root of this. So there's always a questioning, and there's always a sense that these overheated claims are just that. They're claims. They're charges. They're not real. They are reflecting desires that perhaps we don't persist and that we're not healthy. And, you know, you look at the long legacy of this discourse, but all the while, people continue to be born, they continue to thrive, they continue to, you know, have children. And, you know, the population percentage-wise in the nation remains more or less constant at around 10 to 12%. So clearly, you know, extinction's not happening. Degeneracy is not taking hold of the race.
That helps shape the conversation, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yes. So I think this is really connected to this contentious issue that goes throughout the 20th century into the civil rights movement, into the present day, questions of citizenship and fitness for citizenship. I think it's connected to that.
That's Michelle Mitchell. She's a historian at NYU and author of Righteous Propagation, African Americans and the Politics of Racial Destiny After Reconstruction. Today's episode of Backstory was produced by Tony Field, Nina Ernest, Andrew Parsons, and Jesse Dukes. Emily Charnock is our research and web coordinator, and Jamal Milner is our engineer. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Soldiers come quickly.
Major support for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation. Additional funding is provided by Weinstein Properties and History Channel, history made every day.
Brian Ballow is professor of history at the University of Virginia. Peter Onuf is professor of history emeritus at UVA and senior research fellow at Monticello. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Oh, God.